Welcome to the show, everyone. Good morning. I'm Chuck Anderson. I'll be your host for the rest of the hour. So wherever you're at or whatever you're doing, let us please be part of your morning with a great show about a great man of South Dakota. This is part two of a show we started last week in the home of the Honorable Joe Foss at Scottsdale, Arizona. Joe Foss was the youngest governor ever elected in South Dakota and served two terms from 1955 to 1959. He is a retired general, former commissioner of the American Football League, star of several television sporting shows, author, lecturer, and actually too many honors to possibly list, except, please let us mention that he was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor as a fighter pilot in the Pacific in 1943. He is also a fighter pilot ace of aces with 26 downed enemy aircraft, all confirmed, and it's our privilege to have you with us again, Joe. Joe Foss, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It was a lot of fun going through the show last week. I learned an awful lot about you. And by the way, we want to give credit to the book called A Proud American, the autobiography of Joe Foss, a beautifully well put together book. And who did you say did most of the writing, Joe?
My wife. She did it all. I never wrote any of it.
And this particular book that we have right here in Arizona with us, right here on the table, Joe Foss's table in the kitchen, was checked out of the Huron Public Library.
And as far as the book is concerned, see, my wife has heard me give all these various comments about this stuff. And so she didn't have to go look it up. She's been right there and heard me and been around, so she's very familiar with me, so...
We want to thank you ever so much for autographing this. In fact, it's to the people of South Dakota. He says, had him autograph the library book, says, my best wishes to the folks in here in South Dakota. God bless you, Joe Foss, February 10th, 1996. Thanks for autographing it, Joe.
You're welcome, Chuck.
We had just finished last week's show where you were going to earn some money. And you were making, what, 50 cents an hour trying to get yourself through Augustana College. It was tough in those days to raise some money. What did we have? We had the Depression. We had drought conditions.
Well, the biggest problem right in those days was water. We were going through a tremendous drought. And, of course, what I was getting as far as pay was concerned, running the Tolly's, not running it, I was working at Tolly's filling station up on the corner of 10th and Dakota, was 2 bits an hour. And then so when I'd work it late at night, it was changing truck tires, 25 cents an hour. Of course, all you got for changing a tire was either a quarter or 50 cents if it was a big, tough truck tire. And so, they couldn't afford to pay us big wages. And then, of course, I did get a job that paid more down at John Morrell and worked in various departments there for 43 cents an hour. And, of course, the best income that I had was playing in the municipal band. And you got 3 hours a week in there, with two on Sunday and one on Wednesday. And union pay at the time for a musician was $4 an hour. So here I could sit down and on Sunday make a half a week's wages.
That's right.
From in the filling station there.
What instrument did you play?
I played saxophone.
Well, my daughter, Karen, plays saxophone, so maybe if Karen plays saxophone long enough, she'll have one of these beautiful homes in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Well, you know, it's nice to have a beautiful home. Yeah, I more or less crawled out from under a board. So the home that we had, you know, and there's nothing wrong with just having a roof over your head, see? You don't have to have a fancy place to be a success. These things cost a lot of money to keep up, and but I never was unhappy with when I was just growing up as I did, poor as a church mouse. And of course, we didn't have all of the demoralizing things like television and so forth. It gives you a lot of bad attitudes as far as what you figure, some people figure the world owes them a living. And I've never stopped working. I'll be 81 here in another 6 weeks, and I'm still working. I'm out there beating the trails all the time. I don't sit around listening to the grass grow here.
What I thought was interesting is here you're a retired general, and in the book it says that you were in school and some military men grabbed you and threw you off the stage when Charles Lindbergh was coming in. He had landed in Sioux Falls, and I mean, they just grabbed you and moved you right out of there, huh?
Well, you know, I was a kid, raggy-looking sucker, going up there and cutting through everybody, and I can see why they threw me off there. I wasn't contributing anything. I was just getting in the way. And you have to have some semblance of order, which that's the thing you learn in the United States Marine Corps. You go on the count, and you do what you're supposed to do and not what you think you're supposed to do.
You had a short-lived boxing career. Tell us, please, about, was it Mel Anderson from Lake Preston, South Dakota, that made a believer out of you? What happened?
Well, actually, I'd done very well fighting all my life. I had a lot of fights, not necessarily that many in the ring, but I'd won a lot more than I'd lost. And, of course, I won in this to get to the semifinals in the tournament, and it was to meet Mel Anderson, a kid from Huron College, and who lived in Lake Preston. And my boxing coach was a guy named Horton, who had been very successful in the Olympics for the United States. And Dr. Horton says, now this guy is big and he's green and he's fast. The best thing you can do is knock him out in the first round. Well, the whole deal was that the best thing I could have done was to run, because the guy was big and he was fast. And when I hit him in the nose, he got highly upset, not only physically but mentally, and came after me like a tiger. And in the next few minutes, decked me 11 times. Now, today, if you fall down twice, well, they stop the fight. But on the first punch of the fight, he broke my nose. And, of course, I was breathing in my right ear, as I recall, because my nose was over there by the ear. The blood was running, and I was a bloody mess. And of course, as I say, that's the first time I ever got my picture in the paper. I was down on all fours and gasping for air, and the caption read under the photograph. They didn't give the name. They just said, the face of a fallen fighter, which was my face. But I got over it. I had a broken nose.
Well, there was some controversy. They didn't know quite which, if you went through the ropes or over the ropes.
Right. And they didn't know whether the long count was in effect or what the deal was by the time they got me back in there. That's the first time I ever met the press, by the way. I landed sitting on a typewriter. So it just... they threw me back in and were yelling long count. And I just, it didn't mean too much to me, because I was really taking the pounding.
Reading your book, Joe, I could see where, since you were almost born, you had this desire to float into the air, soar as the eagles. And I remember you were leading a bunch of kids on
follow the leader.
Yes.
And what happened? Well, you were just a young kid.
Well, I just ran up. You know, in the old days, they had these bridges that, they had a lot of superstructure above the river. We'd go up, and it was about a foot wide, and you could run right up the side of it and get on top. So I ran right on up on top of the superstructure and just jumped off. Hit on a pretty solid spot, and my... jaw came down and hit my knee and drove a tooth outside of the, out through the side of my face and broke my collarbone. And nobody else followed me. I was the only one that was darn fool enough to jump off there, so that was the end of the game. I won, but not physically.
You start taking private flying lessons at the Sioux Skyways in Sioux Falls. At the University of South Dakota, you joined the 147th Field Artillery of the National Guard and got the University of South Dakota to establish a Civil Aeronautics Administration course, and in your senior year, joined the United States Marine Corps, and in June, you graduated from the U with a degree in, was it economics?
Business administration.
And then reported for active duty.
Right. I went straight from school to the Marine Corps.
They told you you were too old after you finally got through. You were 26 years old. You wanted to be a fighter pilot?
I was too old to be a fighter pilot as far as they were concerned. And the ones that were thinking that up, of course, there were no written rules to that effect, but they just figured the older you were, the more sense you should have, and you wouldn't be as fearless about going into combat, because combat, in fact, the way I put it, is war is dangerous, wherever you fit into it, in the air, on the ground, under the sea, on the sea. There are no safe places to hide out in a war. It's a matter of life and death. And of course, I wanted to be up in the air on the thing, and was fortunate enough to do that. But I wasn't as conservative as they thought I would be, I guess. And that's why they were always trying to farm me off to be a photo reconnaissance pilot. That is, go out and take pictures of the deal, which is very dangerous, by the way. But you didn't have to lead attacks and be involved in the hit and run stuff, and you hit and ran and hoped you got back with the pictures if you were in the photo recce. And that wasn't for me. I wanted to fight them. I had that in my craw from the very outset.
And if you read the book, ladies and gentlemen, you'll find out that Joe Foss did some rather clever maneuvers and manipulations, wound his way up in September 29th, 1942, to a United States offensive of the war in the Pacific. And this was at New Caledonia. And there's a fellow in Huron that helped service your planes. And there's a lot, I belong to the United States Marine Corps League. And there are people that are very proud of you and did, although you probably won't know the names, they were faces you probably never saw, but they remember you and your most gallant flyers as they would come in and take off, Joe. And we're going to be right back. We're at the end of a segment right now. I want everybody please to stay with us for the rest of the hour as we find out the rest of the life of Joe Foss. You're listening to Personalities with Chuck Anderson. Excuse me. 3, 2, 1. We're back. This is Chuck Anderson. Thanks ever so much for being with us this morning. It's enjoyable having you with us. We'll be with you for the rest of the hour. Our guest, former governor of the state of South Dakota, Joe Foss. Joe, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Great for having a chance to be back here talking to my old friends back there.
You're in the South Pacific, and you have maneuvered yourself to where you're going in to the big United States offensive. These have got to be kind of some trying times. We're not sure, militarily, what the Japanese are throwing at us. They know they want to do everything possible so they don't lose Guadalcanal. What was your role in this, Joe?
Well, I was the executive officer. That's the number two man of a fighter squadron, U.S. Marine Corps, known as VMF 121. The V in Marine lingo stands for heavier than air, M for Marine, and F for fighter, and 121 was the number.
Were you mentally prepared for what you flew into, Joe?
Yeah, I've always been mentally prepared in good shape for anything that came along. I just, I don't worry about it. And of course, I'll have to admit that combat was different than I had anticipated it, having read about it and saw a few pictures of it, still and movie. And when you're suddenly in it, you just like everyone, I think, that's halfway normal has competed in something, whether it's giving their lesson in first grade, giving a story on show and tell day, or being on an athletic team or a debating team or singing in the choir or playing in a ping pong tournament. Whatever it is, if you're real honest about it, you will admit you sort of rise to the occasion. And the only thing that differs in when you're at war is that you really arise to the occasion where you're ready to kill the opposition or get killed. And so you are at your best, you're most alert, and some say, were you afraid? And I said, you tell them, sport. When somebody's shooting at me, I get a little nervous. And I'd never get over that. I never got over it. And of course, all of my life, as a result of having been in combat and war and seeing people get killed, I've realized how important life itself is. And so the big decisions that people have to make, you know, from time to time, don't worry me, never have, compared to life and death itself. Because I think that life is such a wonderful thing. The Lord made these machines that we live in, no two alike, and you're set with what you have. There's not another one around like it. And it goes out of shape from time to time. You try to keep it in shape if you're smart.
You taught your guys to fight aeronautically a little different than what you were supposed to do.
Well, I went at it to win. I went at it, and you know, I maintained that a good attack was something that, if you worked as a team, you could overcome any odds. And of course, you were mentioning there in the last week's show that about the people that serviced the airplanes and worked on them all that I never really got to know, and that's true. Those men kept us in the air to do a job. And anytime you think you're doing it alone, you missed the wagon. Actually, these men, and there weren't women there, so I just say men at that time, worked around the clock to patch the holes, to fix the... See, we operated the engines at only two speeds, full speed and no speed, so that an engine in that coil dust being sucked into it and all was fortunate and lucky to last up to 100 hours. And I give those men that credit, boy, they never stopped, and of course, it wasn't under ideal conditions. Snipers were shooting at them, enemy was flying over dropping bombs, and of course, few of them came apart at the seams over the deal, but the rest of them were just tough, dedicated to this great country of ours. And that's the thing that some people still don't understand, that the men and women that have gone before us have given us this great country by putting their lives on the line, just like we go to a store to purchase a loaf of bread.
Sure good hearing the American talk like that, Joe. Sometimes I have a feeling they've all gone to bed or moved out of the country.
Well, I'm very sensitive about our great country. Here we have the greatest country on the face of the earth. We've given more to more people and still are, and we have so many that do not appreciate it, that live here and that just whine and dine. They put up, the whine. And no matter how bad your fortunes are, you can improve them if you want to get in there tough enough. Now, I'm the first guy in line to help somebody that's physically or mentally in bad shape or somebody that has a tough time of it. And I've gone through those stages of it where I was broke, totally broke, didn't have anything and had to make a comeback on it. And so I'm speaking from experience, not just from something I read in a book.
In 1943, the United States Congress, the President of the United States, awarded you a Medal of Honor. Do you remember, there's a plaque at Pew right now in the Veterans Memorial Building. It's sort of a new, I don't know if you've been there recently, Joe, but they have your plaque and the Medal of Honor winners from the state of South Dakota there. Do you remember how it tells about what you did to receive
that? I don't remember that stuff, but I know there's a plaque there, and that's the main thing. It's there, and the others are there. Al Olson, you know, we roomed together down at the University of South Dakota. He was a Toronto boy that was killed in the infantry and received the Congressional Medal of Honor from South Dakota.
In 1946, you left the Marine Corps to accept appointment as Lieutenant Colonel in the South Dakota Air National Guard and started your political career in 1948, being elected to the South Dakota House of Representatives. What got you started in politics, Joe?
Well, the fact that some of my friends circulated a petition and got me on the ballot. I didn't want to run. I really didn't have any great interest in politics. I knew that my dad always told me that if you're honest, you'll never make a dime in politics anyway. And I wasn't too interested in getting into something I was going to make something at. And he was gospelly right. I remember when he introduced me as a boy to Peter Norbeck. And as Peter Norbeck and a guy named J.D. Kuhn were walking away, Dad says, now if you ever get involved in politics, all you'll ever end up with is a shiny blue serge suit and an old car. So Dad never lived to know that I ever got a little finger into politics, but I remember what he said. But politics is an honest game and supposed to be played on an honest basis, and it's not crooked and dirty. There are crooks there. Of course, there are crooks everywhere. I would say in your own family, if you look close enough, you'll find somebody that will pull some dumb thing, but that isn't right. But the thing about it, politics is the housekeeping of good government, and everybody should take a part in it and at least vote. Get out there to make this form of government work. And ask the people that are running, men or women, that are running, where they stand on an issue. And if you disagree with them, why, tell them why, and go at it on a sensible basis.
In 1954, you were promoted to Brigadier General with the South Dakota National Guard. Well, that's the year I graduated from high school, Joe. Then you ran for governor and was elected in 1955.
Well, I defeated one time there. I wasn't elected the first time I ran for governor. And so then it didn't bother me. I got knocked off. I'd rather have won. And I realized that maybe would make a better governor later, so I came back again, you know, and ran after I served in the Korean War. So, and of course, I could not go into combat in the Korean War because U.S. Air Force had a silly rule that if you had a Congressional Medal of Honor, you weren't allowed to go into the combat zone. So I did have a great job. I was Director of Operations and Training for the Central Air Defense Force, which meant that I could go to 20 different states where our fighters were located and had a chance to fly everything and anything. And I had to build up a lot of time and had a great time talking to people and contributing in a different way to the war effort.
As you look back on your 4 years that you served the people of the state of South Dakota, and they overwhelmingly reelected you for your second term. As you look back now, Joe, some years ago, what do you feel is one of the more important things that you did for the state and that you left behind for the future generations?
Well, I think just getting new industries interested in the state of South Dakota and a good highway system And as far as buildings were concerned and salaries were concerned at the universities and their charitable and penal institutions, and I just looked at the overall thing as trying to do things that would make it easier for agriculture to pay the bill in South Dakota. See, the way it was, agriculture, and they still do, bear the brunt of the taxes in the great state of South Dakota. And farming, as you know, is an up and down deal. It's a gamble from the word go. And the Eastern establishment doesn't seem to realize that they need it. I just heard a gal on television last night saying, about talking about the primary race in Iowa. Oh, they had that. I always think as Iowa is just another place that doesn't amount to too much. Iowans, I bet, that were listening, their hair was just standing on end. And then, you know, that's the way they think of South Dakota, North Dakota, and Minnesota, and all of the Nebraska. You go down the center of the United States in the west there. In fact, those that live in the east would just soon shove us off and forget about us, not realizing they'd get mighty hungry because we take good care of them, raising all this stuff. But they just, you know, they want to take everything away from the people out west and battle you all the time, give you a hard time, and haven't the slightest idea what goes on.
We'll be back. Our guest is Governor Joe Foss.